Good afternoon and welcome to the October meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the mid-coast of Maine in Northport. And a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Dick Snyder and I'm a long-standing board member of the Forum. The Forum is celebrating its 31st anniversary. It's been in existence since 1983. We meet monthly to hear an expert from the world on foreign affairs, academia, international business, journalism, to talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States, and to answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Jim Hightower. Jim is a national radio commentator, writer, public speaker, and author of the book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. He was twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner. One of the ironies of history is that he was succeeded in his role as Agricultural Commissioner by the now Governor of Texas, Rick Perry, a contrast that couldn't be more pronounced. Jim is a modern-day Johnny Appleseed, spreading the message of progressive populism across the American grassroots. He frequently appears on television and radio programs, and he broadcasts daily radio commentaries that are carried on more than 150 commercial and public radio stations, on the web and also on Radio Peace International. Each month, he publishes a populist political newsletter, The Hightower Lowdown, which now has more than 135,000 subscribers and is the fastest growing political publication in America. He's a New York Times best-selling author and has written 7 books, including one that's my favorite, If God Had Meant Us to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates. He's a graduate of the University of Texas and did some postgraduate studies in international relations at Columbia University, New York. The late political columnist Molly Ivins said, if Will Rogers and Mother Jones had a baby, Jim Hightower would be that rambunctious child, mad as hell with a sense of humor. Jim Hightower, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dick. I've come to know him over the last several hours. Oscar Wilde said, be yourself, everyone else is already taken. And I think we could say that of Dick Snyder. I'm here with Susan DeMarco, my co-author, cohort, and co-conspirator over the many, many years, and we've been to Camden probably 4 or 5 times, but we've never been to the summit, so this is a particular joy, and I appreciate them drawing the shades, because otherwise I'm sure I would see nothing but the back of your heads looking out at this spectacular view here. I just thank the Forum for allowing a scruffy Texas populist to come in here and be part of your foreign policy palooza here in the greater Lincolnville Metroplex. Makes me happier than a flea at a dog show, in fact, to be standing up here looking out at all of you free thinkers and truth seekers as you do something that is as unusual as it is altogether commendable, namely trying to be an informed and involved citizen in foreign affairs, in this twisted tangle of foreign relations, and in the even more baffling blur of U.S. foreign policy. I think of the confusion that foreign policy gives so many people in terms of a singer-songwriter in Austin, Texas, named Butch Hancock, part of a triumvirate there with Joe Ely and Jimmy Dale Gilmore called the Flatlanders. They were all born out in Lubbock. And Bush was on a radio show that DeMarco and I had, a talk show that we had some years ago, and he was explaining to us how confusing it was to be a teenage boy growing up in that puritanical, pious, absolutist culture of Christian fundamentalism. And he explained to us that that they would teach that sex was just the nastiest, filthiest thing on earth, and you should save it for someone you love. So I find that most Americans view our foreign entanglements as convoluted and confusing as Butch's sex education there in Lubbock. I presume, of course, that you invited me, a Texan, because of the renowned record that we Texans have on international affairs. I grew up, of course, trying to get Lyndon Johnson out of office because of his Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the quagmire of Vietnam that was pointedly singled out by the great Pete Seeger in that song, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy and the Big Fool Says to Push On. At that time, I was trying to get Johnson out of office, not realizing he would be the most progressive president of my lifetime. Another story. Then we moved on to George W., of course, and his weapons of mass destruction. Leading him at one point to try to be articulate, he said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me, you can't get fooled again. And now we've got Rick Oops Perry, who is trying to run for president again, saying that he's an expert on arming and sealing off the U.S.-Mexican border because murderous militants from ISIS could be crossing that border into the United States. And he was asked, could be? And he said, well, there's no actual evidence of it, but it certainly could happen. And he pointed out that many people have been apprehended coming across from countries with terrorist ties. And asked to name one, he said, well, just recently there were three individuals from Ukraine were apprehended at that border. Of course, Ukraine is not a country with terrorist ties, but nonetheless, this is also the governor who just a couple of weeks ago scolded the federal government, saying it should pay more attention to state governments because states are the lavatories of good government. So, beware of Texans purporting to explain foreign policy with any level of expertise. In fact, most of our Texas leaders have been as confused as goats on AstroTurf when it comes to trying to even understand what foreign policy is about. So I come to you with no pretension of foreign policy expertise, but simply as a hard-traveling, populist wanderer through half a century of bellicose foreign relations led by weak presidents, meek congresses, money-seeking war lobbyists, and freaky think tank ideologues playing war from their lazy boy recliners. I do a lot of traveling, speechifying, visiting with ordinary outside-the-beltway folks in my line of work. Been just about every place that's got a zip code in this country, and I can tell you that Washington policymakers are closer to Pluto than they are to the thinking and ideals of the workaday people whom I encounter. Susan and I come from not just Austin, Texas, but from South Austin. And we have a little different attitude, somewhat irreverent. Molly was from over there as well. In fact, our unofficial slogan is, we're all here because we're not all there. And I think that the powers that be in our country are not at all there in terms of reflecting the deep democratic values and the belief in pursuing the common good that ordinary folks hold within them. They see this disconnect in domestic policy, of course, the yawning chasm of inequality that we're experiencing, the deliberate wage depression and decline of the middle class, the outright purchase of politicians and public policy sanctioned by a Supreme Court who says that money is speech. Well, people are pretty quick to figure out that if money is speech, then speech is no longer free, right? By definition. But they see this disconnect also in terms of the way our presidents and Congress critters and Pentagon heffies and a smug club of experts approach America's role in the world in matters of war, of peace, of diplomacy, of trade, of treaties. The dominant interest, in fact, the determinant interests. Is always pretty much corporate. They they try to pretty up their policies, the powers that be, and their pursuits with phrases like democracy, about the urgent role, national interests, about the humanitarian needs of our world. But it's kind of like trying to put earrings on a hog. It just doesn't hide the ugliness that is down in the reality of so many of our foreign policies. They grandly assert, for example, that America is promoting and protecting democracy throughout the world. Yet there's practically zero democracy involved in their decision-making. We're now at war, for example, in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen and Libya and Iraq, Syria and beyond. Yet Congress has not declared a single one of these wars, is not much informed on most of them. And the American people, of course, have not even been given a rational explanation for most of them, much less been consulted. We must go to war against these terrible terrorists, we're told. Obama said as much. Senator Lindsey Graham said that Obama needs to step up, to rise to the occasion before we all get killed back here at home. We got John Boehner saying, we have no choice but to put boots on the ground in these wars, and including in the Syrian and Iraq Levant war. Well, as I say in New Orleans, we, who dat say we? Who we? Well, it's never them. It's not their loved ones who are going to go to war. It's not the one percenters. Rather, it's our families, our public funds, our national reputation, our future that are being sacrificed for their wars, perennial war, perpetual wars. Allow me to review just a couple of the corporate misadventures that I find us in. Start with that one of the Islamic State, or ISIS, ISIL, the Long War, it's now being called, even before it's fully started, the Long War. Well, yes, this is a cult of sadism, as the New York Times put it in an editorial last week. And yes, there has to be a true global coalition of sanity and humanity to eliminate it. But why is war our first and only alternative, our first and only response? And why is it America's war to organize and lead? Well, one reason is Jack Keane. Most people have never heard of Jack Keane. But it's not about him alone, but he's among a gaggle of ex-generals who've been on Fox TV and on CNN, on talk radio yak shows. He's been testifying before Congress, been at think tank confabs. He's been out there with Tea Party hoorahs, all in one big war whoop to say that we must have airstrikes against the Islamic State. We must send more military advisors. We must have boots on the ground. We must intervene with full force to fix the Muslim world. Of course, they use fix in the same way that a veterinarian uses it. So if you're confused on that, ask your cat. Well, who are these guys? Who's Jack Keane? They're identified when they appear on television and speeches, etc., only as ex-generals. Well, Keane is a paid advisor or on the board of Blackwater, as well as General Dynamics. His Institute for the Study of War is funded by Raytheon, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, Dyn Corporation, and L3 Communications. So thus, he's out there saying, we got to have more missiles against ISIS. Why more missiles? Raytheon is supplying the missiles. It's a war profiteering push that he is making. And his Institute for the Study of War says we need 25,000 U.S. ground troops in Syria right now. Or you can look at trade policy in our country. NAFTA, right? We were told about the glories of globalization by Bill Clinton and the Republican leadership as well, by Robert Rubin and the people that Clinton appointed there, the cheerleaders of globalization. Well, bovine excrement, as we say out in Lubbock. Factories closed, jobs exported, cities hollowed out, including Detroit. Detroit didn't happen just in the last year or two. It got hollowed out by corporations leaving that city, many of them directly because of NAFTA. Corporations got the gold mine and the people got the shaft out of this deal. And the people of Mexico were also those who got the shaft, because suddenly here came Cargill and ADM moving into Mexico with their corn produced in this country to overwhelm the small ejitos, the small tiny farms in Mexico. Those farmers, tens of thousands of them, lost their livelihood. Shopkeepers lost because Walmart moved in with Chinese goods to drive them out of business. That's where the immigration came from. That's why people were pouring across our borders, not because they wanted to come in here and take our jobs, but because they were desperate. They had to have some kind of income, and there was nothing left for them in Mexico during those years after NAFTA. And now comes something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Very nice sounding terms, right? Trans, that means across. Pacific, that's very serene. Partnership, that's cooperation. We're all for those things. But what it is a supersized, nuclearized NAFTA. 11 countries are now going to be combined with us, from Brunei to Vietnam. Japan already in. It's going to include China on down the road. This thing has been negotiated in strict secrecy since 2008. Vast majority of the American people never heard of it. But it's about to come before the Congress, if Obama gets his way. Yet the Congress itself has been shut out of the process. No member of Congress can go to the negotiations, can participate, even sit as observers. No member of Congress can look at the drafts of the proposals that are coming out of this Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation. No member of Congress is involved. But there are 600 outsiders who have been allowed to be inside, sitting around the table in the negotiation. They are members of the industry trade advisory committees from A to Z, from AT&T to Zippo, from Koch Brothers to Walmart. They are sitting at the table. They are submitting their own drafts of proposals. They are reviewing the proposals that other countries put forward with some element of a veto power in their hands to be able to cast. So 600 corporate interests are around the table, but the people's interests, no labor is sitting around there, no environmental group is sitting there, no, just people's organization sitting around there. And of the 29 chapters that form this new agreement, so-called, though we don't get to agree on it, but nonetheless, there it is. Of the 29 chapters that are drafted, only 5 have anything to do with trade. The rest of them have to do with corporate protectionism, allowing corporations to become more dominant in the world. Just one little example. You might have a Buy Camden program to support your local businesses, for your city government, county government, school board, et cetera, to buy local product. You might have a Buy American product as a state. You might have a bioorganic program. All of those outlawed by the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You would not be allowed to have it because all these 11 other nations would have the right to come in and bid on any procurement contract that is put forth in America whatsoever. You cannot put those qualifiers on that contract. Same thing with fracking. The Department of Energy would be relieved of its duty to regulate any fracking of gas that is going to be exported to any of these countries. And by the way, most of the gas that is produced by fracking is going to be exported out of our country, mostly to China, somewhat to Brazil, and somewhat to Europe. Drug prices, we would not be, it outlaws countries being able to negotiate on drug prices, as we do with the military program, and as we do with Medicaid as well. Not Medicare. We're not allowed to do it with Medicare, but we can do it. Food safety. Our food safety laws would be subject to challenge by any of these other 11 nations. The banking regulations that we put forth on too big to fail, we could not sustain those. They would be challenged by these other nations. Ron Kirk, who was Obama's first U.S. trade representative and involved in the negotiations of these provisions, these 29 chapters of the TPP, said that it must be kept secret during the negotiation process, because the American people would be outraged by the details that are in it, and Congress would be spooked, so we could not pass it if the people knew what was in it. This is why Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. One more example. GMOs, genetically manipulated organisms that are going into our food supply, better than 90% of the corn, better than 90% of soybeans, most of the soybeans, et cetera, are now produced with GMO seeds, produced overwhelmingly by Monsanto Corporation. Overwhelmingly, though, the people in the world and the people in the United States do not want GMOs in their food. Overwhelming majorities, roughly right toward 90% of Democrats and independents and about 80% of Republicans oppose GMOs in the food and want at least to have labeling that these corporations be required to say this product contains GMOs. So we as consumers can make an enlightened decision of whether that's what we want to buy or not. But Monsanto has fought that at every turn, in the courts, in the Congress, in the states, in local elections, everywhere, at every turn. Monsanto has been in the face of it. Sort of a don't ask, don't tell policy is what they're after with it. And had a little experience with this personally early last year with something called the World Food Prize. It bills itself as the Nobel Prize of Food, based out in Des Moines, Iowa. Has been a good program in the past. It's recognized people developing small-scale water systems, for example, for villages in Africa and South America and elsewhere. But this year, they had a different proposal, and I was invited to be a part of it, not a part of the World Food Prize, but a part of the citizen protest against the World Food Prize. The protest arose because it was going to be awarded to Monsanto Corporation. And the fact that Monsanto had just given $5 million to the World Food Prize had nothing to do with their selection as the honoree. In fact, Monsanto had been really heavily lobbying the Vatican to support GMOs as a solution to world hunger. So again, they're addressing up their real intention as a noble endeavor. And the Vatican was wobbling some, but it was going to come to this awarding of the World Food Prize to Monsanto. In fact, their representative was to be a cardinal out of Ghana, who was the number three ranking official from the Vatican, head of their peace and poverty programs over there. And he was coming, but local citizens got together and they sent the cardinal a letter asking if he would come to their protest speeches as well, their protest effort. And they had first gone to the local bishop, and he said, no, I won't write such a letter. You know, it's inappropriate. He's going to go to the official meeting. So again, citizen rebelled and sent the letter. Lo and behold, the cardinal wrote back and said, yes, I will come to your meeting. And then the bishop had to meet with his own local constituents. And the bishop said, well, all right, he's coming, but he's going to give a 10-minute speech, and he's going to leave. That's it. And the cardinal wrote back and said, no, I'm going to spend an hour with the local farmers and hear what they're saying about what these GMO seeds are doing to them and to their livelihood. And not only am I going to speak, but I'm going to hang around and hear Hightower speak. So this led to a big brouhaha. And in fact, I got a call from Senator Tom Harkin, whom I've known for quite a few years. And he was laughing when he called because the head of the World Food Prize had called his office asking him to call me and ask that I not go to Des Moines, which made me rush out and book my ticket that very day. So my message to you, and I'm sure you're wondering what it is by now, is simply that it's up to us. It's not up to Obama, not up to the Congress, not up to the corporate lobbyists, for sure. They're not going to do it for us. They're the ones doing it to us. So We have to do the heavy lifting, which has always been the case in our democracy. You go all the way back, the first presidential election that chose George Washington as our chief of state. Only 4% of the people were even eligible to vote. If you were a woman, you couldn't vote. If you were Native American, African American, if you were not of European descent and owned property, you could not vote. Very narrow concept of democracy. So when we celebrate July 4th, we're not celebrating those documents. We're celebrating the intervening people like you right here in this room who have fought, bled, and died to democratize those documents, to extend that political possibility of self-government to more and more of our population. So we can have the kind of foreign policies that are of, by, and for the people. How? By demanding it. That's how. Just as intervening people, the suffragists, the abolitionists, the populists, the wobblies, the strong labor movement, then the environmental movement, the women's movement, right on down to today, Martin Luther King Jr., Cesar Chavez. The people, have always had to be the agitators that create policies that add a little bit more democracy to our effort. And when they call you an agitator, you can say back to them, that's the center post in the washing machine that gets the dirt out. We need a lot more of that, don't we? Well, they say that the first job of a citizen is to keep your mouth open, and we're pretty good at that. But it helps if that mouth is attached to a brain. And that is the importance of organizations like this forum. Because you provide connections to each other, to information and insights, to action that sustain the notion of us being a self-governing people, that give us that ability and that confidence to dare to step out and be brave and do what democracy demands of us. I think of groups like the Forum in terms of a little hardware store near our home in South Austin, called Harold's Hardware. And it's not one of these big box things. It's not bigger than this room right here. But it's a great place. You can go to Harold's. You don't have to buy the whole carton of nails. They'll sell you two nails if that's what you want, you know. They'll say, well, what are you trying to do? And I'll say, well, you know, I want to build a lectern. Well, let's pencil it out here and see what you need. They'll loan you a tool. You can take a tool home and bring it back when you're through. And the slogan at Harold's Hardware is, together, we can do it yourself. Now, that's got to be our slogan, doesn't it? That's democracy slogan, because we can't do it ourselves. But together, we can do anything we put our little brain cells to work on. And the good news is that as I travel the country, I find that the people of America are revolting in the very best sense of that term. They're reaching out now, not just a group here and a group there having a rebellion, and rebellions are us. That's the other thing the history classes and the powers that be don't want us thinking about, but rebellion didn't happen in 1776. It happens every single day across this country with some group or some group of groups or some coalition of groups are in rebellion against the powers that be running roughshod over them. And now those groups are beginning to see, wait a minute, we're kind of all in this together. We're connecting here. Maybe we should team up. And now they're taking it a step further by linking up internationally. We've seen in the last couple of years the phenomena of fast food workers, the least likely workers in America to rebel because their jobs are so insecure. They are so disorganized. It's so difficult to organize them. Yet, lo and behold, they've been in the streets. And they've done these rolling strikes across America for more than 2 years now. And the American people overwhelmingly support them because they see their own future being the same future that the fast food workers are experiencing today with this new normal of a low-wage economy that is being developed for us. So they're in rebellion. But the fast food workers have teamed up now, and the last action that they had was against McDonald's, and it was through hundreds of cities and towns in our country, but it was also in 24 other countries, a deliberate coordination of an effort, knowing that people there are linked directly to our own interests. Same with climate change. That's a worldwide phenomenon now, the rebellion against the denial of climate change. As Jesse Jackson put it some years ago, we might not all have come over on the same boat, but we're in the same boat now. That's a powerful political reality, and it's beginning to come together, and that is why I come to you with a bit of optimism. And I'll leave you with this thought and get to your questions and comments, observations, insights, any good jokes you have. It's from Patti Smith, the great rocker, who sings that the people have the power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. That's our challenge. Thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Stay here again.
Yeah.
Well, that was both inspiring and challenging. One can hope that foreign relations leads to better foreign policy. I will do my best to read these questions and see what we can. You had your recent articles in the Lowdown took on Amazon, and the questioner wonders if you've received any feedback or reaction from Amazon or from Jeff Bezos.
My Amazon account has been canceled. not directly from Bezos or from Amazon, but indirectly, because actually DeMarco came up with this idea in the second issue of taking on Amazon. We included an urging of our readership to express themselves to Bezos directly, and we listed his direct email site, and we did that because in terms of him driving not only bookstores but commercial businesses, shopkeepers in every town and every shopping center in America out of business by predatory pricing, by unfair tax advantages, and just by general meanness. He has done that in the name of the consumer. He says it's always in the interest of the consumer. So I am speaking for the consumer. So we have urged our readers to send a message saying, not in my name, you're not. I am a consumer, and you are not speaking for me, because I don't want a policy that's going to eliminate the aesthetics and the dynamic and the economic possibilities of my community by a faraway monopolist, which is what Amazon has become. And the emails have poured in to Amazon headquarters, and several hundred have sent copies of those to us, and they're quite creative and fun. And they include former employees, including high-ranking employees of Amazon. And they include a bunch of Amazon Prime members. So it definitely has gotten their attention, and that was our goal, to mainly let the public know, because Amazon has a good reputation, and we began with that. It is a company that you click on that little button, and lo and behold, the next day, there's the Fed Express guy, you know, right there with whatever it was that you didn't need, but it's at your doorstep anyway. It's there in a hurry. And so people say, wow, this is great. And those discounts, I mean, the price discounts are just stupendous. Well, those discounts come at a price that the workers in Amazon warehouses are paying that are just extraordinary. And then the price of eliminating the competition of our own independent businesses in this country and the creativity of our independent business people. So we've taken it on. We'll see what happens. But we certainly have their attention, and we've gotten a bunch of progressive groups and conservative groups around the country that are now saying, well, we didn't know all this, and so we're changing our attitude toward Amazon as well.
Just following up on the joining together of progressive and sometimes conservative groups. Somebody asked about the revolt happening on both sides, progressives and fundamentalists, though progressives sometimes view fundamentalists as voting against their own interests, for example, wage increases, climate change measures, regressive taxation. How do we unite to prevent competing revolts from involving a civil war among us? Yes.
Yeah, I think that is exceptionally important and also possible, and it is happening. In our last book, The Swim Against the Current, Susan and I have a chapter in there about the evangelical environmental movement, and this came as a great shock to the progressives that we deal with, that there would be such a thing. And they thought, well, surely it's just a front group, a hokey thing. But no, it's a very serious movement. And they don't call it environmentalism. They call it creation care. But who the hell cares what they call it? It's the same thing. It's us coming together. And they began to recognize, and by they, I mean that it was led by the top lobbyists of the evangelical movement, top lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and many of the big-time pastors with those churches of 25 or 35,000 members in them. And they are recognizing that it's not just one verse in the gospel about gay rights or about abortion, but it is the entirety of the gospel that they really care about. And so now they're reaching out to a bigger community. And I spoke in Colorado Springs with the head of the Family Council there, the American Family Council Group. We joined together in a conversation in his church. So it's possible to have these conversations, but we have to make the conversations happen. They're very wary of us, and as I tell the groups that I speak to, you don't have to go to church with them, but you might be outside offering to have a cup of coffee with them when they come out and go to the cafe and see what it is we have in common rather than starting with what we do not have in common.
We have a number of questions about Texas. I'll just read a few of these, and you can pick any that you wish to respond to, Jim. Will Texas secede? And what would the USA look like under President Perry? And what's your view on Texas Senator Cruz's foreign policy and understanding?
Okay.
You pick.
Might do them all. Texas seceding. Despite the wishes of the other 49 states, I think we will not choose to do that. The main reason being that it's stupid. And the second reason being that all you have to say to the Rick Perrys and people who suggest this idea is, oh, okay, so you're not going to take the money from the defense budget that you're now drawing in your communities all across the state of Texas. Oh, no, we didn't mean that. Well, you're going to be a separate country. I don't think you're going to get the U.S. military to finance you, and et cetera. So it's pretty easy to deal with. The USA would look like under a President Perry, it would have better hair than we now do. But it would also be a model, in fact, the picture-perfect model of the poster boy of the low-wage economy. Perry runs around saying, I've created a million jobs since I've been governor. Well, he hasn't. He's created a million jobettes. Low wage, no benefits, no upward mobility, no security attached to them at all. In fact, Texas under Perry has created more minimum wage jobs than all other 49 states combined have created. We're a low, low wage state with no labor rights, with no worker rights, very little opportunity even to join a union, despite the fact that most people want to join one now. So you could say to a waitress or a waiter in Austin, did you know Perry's created a million new jobs? And she'd say, yeah, I know, I have three of them. So that's with that one. Take Senator Cruz, please. That's all I can say there. The senator from Canada by way of Cuba is a complete, full-fledged nutball, and he's very, very, and he's seriously dangerous, so much so that even the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate recognize that. So I think he's doing himself in, though we can't count on that. We have to do our part. I once said about Phil Graham, who was trying to run for president years ago, that I saw a TV interview with another Republican leader from the Senate, and he said, well, sometimes Phil is his own worst enemy. And I said, not while I'm alive, he's not. So I think that's the attitude we have to take with Ted Cruz.
Well, that leads to another question. Who besides you is leading this rebellion that's going on within the country?
Yeah, well, a number of people. I was just in Chicago with a group called the National People's Action, led by a guy named George Gale. He's out of a small town in Indiana, now headquartered in Chicago. They've got more than a dozen, I think it's about 15, state affiliates and organizations around the country. They're one in Iowa, for example, the Iowa Committee for Community Improvement, just a benign-sounding name, very aggressive coalition of farmers with labor, with environmentalists, with teachers, with students, with the whole bunch all together. And they are having a profound impact on the legislature, both in elections and then in terms of the policies that are adopted, because they go to the legislature with their own program. They don't wait on the lobbyists and the lawmakers to come up and decide what the program's going to be. They create their own agenda and go get it. Very aggressive, very effective, very well-trained organization. So groups like that thrive. There's Wellstone Action. There's Progressive Majority. There's two or three of these organizations that will come into a community and help you organize to run for office or to organize to be a campaign manager or to train to be a community organizer or whatever. They do very, very effective jobs. They're electing hundreds of state legislators, city council members, what we call a farm team that would then percolate up into ultimately members of Congress and Senate and et cetera. So this leadership is there. And then there's all sorts of even media leadership, a great job that the independent news weeklies are doing, that radio like from Amy Goodman, Tom Hartman, et cetera, the work that they do, the efforts of MSNBC, all of this counts. It adds up to something profound. And then, of course, the independent bookstores and our public libraries. They're tremendous community resources for getting out word and bringing people together. So that's another tool that you have available for yourself. So basically, it comes down to us. There's no grand sparkly who's going to stand forward. We've got our, you know, Ralph Naders and Michael Moores and Molly Ivins before and people like that, but we're not the ones who matter. What matters is that there's real organization taking place at a grassroots level, and that is happening.
Several people are concerned about the Citizens United and wonder whether or not you are optimistic about reversing that and how we could get behind that movement.
Yes, I am optimistic, and largely because, again, the organizing that's happening at the grassroots level. This is something that even the Democrats in Washington had basically surrendered on. You know, well, we'll try to get a little bit of disclosure about who's giving the money. You know, which is like, okay, go ahead and commit the crime, but you got to tell us about it. You know, but the people were not taking that. So there's two major groups, one called Move to Amend, and the other called something or other, the People's Amendment. And both of them have organizers all across the country. We have now 16 states and more than 600 cities and counties have petitioned the Congress formally asking for a constitutional amendment to be sent to overrule Citizen United, overrule the notion that a corporation is a person and that money is speech. That's remarkable that it has happened in such a very short time with that many people, and not just from you expect California to do it, you expect New York to do it, but just red states as well are a part of this. But there's another one of those issues that 78% of Republicans oppose corporate money in politics and want an amendment to take it out. So this is not something you have to go convince the people about. We've just got to organize them and rally them and give them focus and bring them together to bear on these positions of power. And as you probably know, last month, I guess it was, yes, there was a vote in the U.S. Senate on an amendment to do away with Citizen United ruling. And that vote passed in terms of a majority vote. It did not pass in terms of the two-thirds majority that it would have to have. But nonetheless, it forced about a three-day debate on the floor of the U.S. Senate, a debate that the money sources, that the Koch brothers, that the Republican leadership did not want to even have. But they had to have it. They had to face up to it. That's a big step forward. More and more states are going to do it. That activism is going to continue. And this is one we're going to win because the people overwhelmingly make it, want it, and it is so destructive, so totally destructive to our democratic possibilities that it has to happen.
Two other questions about Texas that just came up. The first, can a progressive candidate ever again win statewide office in Texas? And the second one, would you please speak about the challenges facing women's rights in Texas and in the world?
Yes, I'm an expert on women. But let's start with Texas. We will most certainly elect statewide progressive candidates. Progressives, or at least Democrats, and even really progressives, are the overwhelming majority of the people of Texas. Texas did not turn right-wing and did not turn Republican. It quit voting. And that began in the 1990s and has gotten worse subsequently. And this has occurred because my party, the Democratic Party, again, I was elected much to the amusement of the people to a couple of terms for statewide office. But since then, my party turned to get that same corporate money that the Republicans have been taking. And I can tell you, when you take that corporate check, written on the back of it is the corporate agenda. And so you quit talking about not just jobs, but jobs with good wages and good benefits and power. You quit talking about health care for all. You quit talking about et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the working stiffs, the majority of folks, were not hearing them in the message of either the Republican or Democratic Party. So in 2010, when Perry was reelected as governor, we had the lowest voter turnout in America. We had 32% of the people vote. That makes him the choice of 18% of the people. But we've not been getting 19%. So that's our challenge. And now we've got a new state party chair, a new state party organization. When this new chairman, Gilberto Hinojosa, took office just 4 years ago, we had four organizers working for the state Democratic Party. Now we've got more than 100 working for the state party. And we're in not just the blue dots like Austin, but in the hard red places like Amarillo. Unbeknownst to Republicans or Democrats until Hinojosa came in, Amarillo is now 40% Mexican-American. Nobody's organized them. Now we're beginning to organize. And as our candidates begin to have a stronger, more populist sort of message, speaking to workaday people again, that population, and we do more organizing, that population will begin to turn out, and we will win every single election. And when Texas turns blue, or whatever color you want to call it, then the nation turns blue for every, certainly every presidential election, and most other elections are out there. So we have that possibility. This year we have two strong women candidates, Wendy Davis, state senator, running for governor, who has a real shot at winning. She's behind at the moment, and seriously behind in money raising, but she's raised a substantial amount of money, enough money to get her message out there. It depends on whether she's going to have a strong enough populist message. I'm unsure of that yet. But also we have Letitia Van de Putte, who is another state senator running for lieutenant governor. Very powerful office in Texas. The lieutenant governor appoints all committee chairs, names all the members to the committees, decides what legislation gets considered, what brings to the floor, et cetera. Enormously powerful office. She has a real shot at winning, in part because her Latina possibilities are going to draw a lot of voters to her that wouldn't necessarily go to Wendy. So we've got these two dynamic women candidates that are out there, and they're certainly going to advance this progressive possibility of Texas. Whether they're going to win or not this time, I don't know. But you got to keep going. You know, you don't win the first time out. You don't win sometimes the second or third, you know, but you got to keep plugging. Willie Nelson told me that the early bird might get the worm, but it's the second mouse that gets the cheese. And central to that are women's rights. Both the Wendy and Letitia's campaigns are rooted in the filibuster that we had in the state Senate last year over abortion rights in our state, and the dynamism that came out of that was just electric. So that same thing is taking place around the world, not just around questions of abortion, but of course even questions of, can women even get educated in a number of countries? Can they not be killed if they're lawyers? You know, that kind of thing. But that's rising to the top as well. And again, I see a unity coming together around the world of various aspects of women's issues coming to bear.
Jim, you've often said that the only real change can come from those in power, not from those in power, but from those on the outside. So let me take you abroad now. The Arab Spring promised just such a possibility to at least many of us. What's your opinion about the failed expectations of so many of the populist uprisings in the Middle East? And do they give you pause for your own optimism about our possibilities of a populist movement here?
No, they just reinforce the obvious fact that it is extraordinarily difficult to take on concentrations of money and power. Again, you take a step forward, you might get knocked two steps back. But none of those forces, whether in Ireland or in Egypt or any of the other nations, are going away. They keep coming back, and they're going to gain strength, particularly among young people, if we do our job. Which is to get behind those young people with an educational message, not a propaganda message, but a message of hope, of their importance and of their and of the humanity's possibilities to come together, and the idealism that they actually have, that's being captured by these beyond extreme groups, the raw just nastiness of groups like ISIS. Out there. It doesn't have to go that way, but we have to do something besides war to address that. In fact, some of that war we're going to be creating in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere is going to lead to new recruits for them. So we've got to address this in a multi-pronged effort, at least equal to what we're going to put into war, if we have a hope of drawing those young folks into a positive, progressive, at least quasi-democratic rebellion and world. I'll give you one little bright spot is what's going on in Hong Kong. Now, they're being clubbed now, but they're certainly not going away, and that's overwhelmingly led by not just young people, by high school students. The number one leader is 17 years old. He couldn't even officially vote. But he's a powerhouse. And that is linked to what's now going on in Golden, Colorado, where a right-wing school board dictated that there should be a patriotic teaching of history out there. And we should not talk about the Native Americans. We should not talk about the Chinese Americans. We should not talk about anything negative. We certainly shouldn't talk about socialism. We shouldn't talk about any of these negative things. We should only talk about the glories of the United States of America and of the I Ching and, et cetera. And the students rebelled. It was the kids in high school that rebelled. And now the city council has had to pull back, or the school board, rather, has had to pull back from the agenda that they put forward. They're not going away, but still, we've won that first battle in what is going to be a prolonged war there. This, people are not going to take it. They're not going to be dictated to by propagandists and power mongers, which is really what this is about.
In keeping with the criticism of war, the U.S. has conducted an obviously failed policy, a so-called war on drugs. You've been a vocal critic of our policy to ban the growing of hemp in the United States. forcing us to rely on imports from China, Canada, and so forth, though we are the largest consumer of hemp products in the world. What are the consequences, if any, for our foreign policy of this war on drugs and our failure to allow hemp to be grown in this country?
Well, yes. I mean, if ignorance is bliss, we must be ecstatic when it comes to the way we deal with drugs generally, and you know, calling it a war and spending roughly $20 billion a year on that war, leading to disastrous consequences abroad and in our own country, in what is essentially a health problem, not a legal problem, a law problem. But then also in denying the economic potential, the economic stimulus that would come from hemp. And the good news there is that the last farm bill, I think it is, allows at least experimentation in the growing of hemp, and a number of farmers are doing that. North Dakota has led in it. Colorado is doing a whole lot of it. And groups like Dr. Bronner's Soaps and that company, they're pioneers in it. They will buy every ounce of hemp that is produced in the United States. They're begging for it, and they're leading, saying, why in the world are we having to go to China to get this product? Why can't we do it here? So I think common sense will rise to high places.
Jim, we've come to the end of our time. I will read something that is not a question, but one person said, Molly would be proud. Oh,
thank you. Thank you.
Stay here, just a minute.